Hello, everyone, and welcome to House of Fire and Blood, the podcast where we ask, what if George R. R. Martin's Fire and Blood were told more like HBO's show, House of the Dragon? Hey, everyone. My name is Gretchen. I'm one of the hosts, and I use they, them pronouns, and I am here with my co-host, Caroline.
Hey, I'm Caroline, I use she, her pronouns, and we are continuing our analysis of Fire and Blood by George R. R. Martin. I assume you guys know that because we're many episodes into this podcast series, but on the off chance you're new here, welcome.
Welcome.
We're about to start the chapter, The Dying of the Dragons, A Son for a Son.
Whee!
It's gonna get bad. This episode's gonna be okay. This is a nice section. Because we're only reading up to, if you have the book, we're reading up to page, from the beginning of the chapter, to page 418, to the line, had his brother's shorter saber flight gone as well, much bloodshed and grief might have been averted. So this first section is fine. Next episode won't be. Be prepared.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Next episode is just, like, going to be trigger warnings for, like, terrible things happening.
Just sometimes. Sometimes Martin writes a lot of violence, and we have to very seriously question whether he needed to. Anyway, in this section, we meet so many fun ladies in this section.
We do. So last episode we ended with Rhaenyra had been crowned queen. Aegon's not super happy about that. But now we're kind of seeing what are the next moves that especially the Blacks are making as they're, you know, definitely already at war.
Well, the Maester says in the very beginning that Aegon had been proclaimed king in the Dragon Pit. Rhaenyra was queen on Dragonstone. All efforts at reconciliation having failed, the Dance of the Dragons now began in earnest.
Yeah, and then he's like...
All efforts.
Yeah,
done.
All efforts.
Done.
And the Dance of the Dragons involves Corlys blockading King's Landing.
Yep.
And Daemon going to Harrenhal.
Yep, to raise some troops. Yep.
Involves zero bloodshed in this section, I will just say. This is not what war looks like.
Yeah.
What most people consider war. We will talk about this a little bit more in the analysis, but I've really enjoyed that Gildane was like, yes, Daemon, military prowess. He landed at Harrenhal and Sir Simon was like, how about I surrender?
Yeah, he went there with a dragon, and Sir Simon said, I'll surrender, and then the text said, wow, Daemon's military prowess. Yep. Amazing.
He proved so that good. He is such a good commander.
Wow.
It's like, I'm not doubting that Daemon, he's the only one who's seen battlefield experience. This is nothing against Daemon. This is about the way that Gildane is framing what Daemon does.
Yeah.
Very silly.
Daemon showed up and said, hey, you up, and the castellan said, yeah, here's a castle.
Uh-huh.
Enjoy. And what great prowess. And we encounter, for the first time, Alice Rivers. And is she old? Is she young? How sexy is she? I don't know.
Yeah.
This is all...
Clearly
nobody knows for sure.
The important questions. Gildane out here.
Gildane wants to know.
You have really important questions. How old is she? And how does that influence how sexy we find her or not? Because if
Gildane's
she's old,
like,
she probably shouldn't be sexy.
Gildane's like, Pixar didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. Then the River Lords join the Blacks. There's, unlike season two of the show, there is not a lot of delay. The small folk of the Riverlands are like, yeah, Queen Rhaenyra. And then the Lords are like, yeah, Queen Rhaenyra. This seems fine. Except for the Tullys, who believe that silence is the better part of valor and decide to just, like, hold themselves up in their castle and not side with anybody.
Which Tullys are those? Can you tell me the names of those Tullys?
Yeah.
Those are,
We got Grover and Elmo.
Woo! Elmo, say his fucking name.
Elmo Tully, say his name, House of the Dragon.
The show cut those characters. And they're fucking cowards.
It has.
For cutting Elmo Tully.
Doesn't it have Grover? It has Grover and Oscar. It skips Elmo and Kermit.
Yes.
Because Grover and Oscar, they were like, that sounds like reasonable enough Westerosi names, but we can't.
They went with the arguably not Sesame Street names.
Right.
But give me Elmo. Come on.
I want Elmo.
Come on.
Come on.
Kermit, you gotta do it. It's textual. It's in the source material. Don't be afraid.
Right.
Put that shit on screen. I want to see Daemon Targaryen get in somebody's face and be like, Sir Elmo. Like, come on!
Oh my god, absolutely. Yes.
Let Matt Smith have that.
Yes, let Matt Smith say the words Elmo Tully. Mm-hmm. Lord Elmo Tully.
Lord Kermit.
Yes. Lord Kermit. Yep, absolutely.
You can make a funny frog joke. Come on. Anyway.
I mean, that's part of what's funny to me is that, like, there are people in the Riverlands that get called, like, frogmen because they live in, like, rivers and stuff. So, yeah. Like, he's Kermit the Frogman. Come on. Yes.
You could have him drink some tea with his pinky out, you know, like the meme. We would lose our minds. Oh, let's gosh, do it.
Can you imagine?
This is why we got to run the show. This is why we got to write for HBO, because they're missing the hard-hitting stuff they need. They need a Kermit and Elmo.
Look, like, if you're going to give us fanfic fan service, give us, like, or, like, not even fanfic. If you're going to give us fan service, give us fucking, you know, Elmo and Kermit Tully. Lordy.
Or have Rhaenyra and Alicent kiss, goddammit. I'll take either. Okay. Anyway,
while, you know, Daemon is busy treating with Elmo Tully, Jace goes to the Vale, where we meet Lady Jane. We Yay. Love Lady Jane. She seems pretty great on the show already. I do think she seems cool.
Yep. Yep.
Who agrees to support Rhaenyra in exchange for a dragon. We'll talk more about everything that's going on with her in a little bit, but, like, the short version is, same as the show, she's like, sure, I'll side with Rhaenyra, but, like, my vulnerability is dragons, so, like, can you give me a fucking dragon?
And we should note again, sorry, I meant to say this in the beginning, season 2 is out, but Gretchen has not seen the finale, so this episode will not include any finale spoilers. Mm-hmm. So if you're wondering why we're not mentioning that, that's right.
Then Jace from the Vale goes to meet with the Manderleys, where he agrees to marry off his youngest brother to Lord Manderly's daughter.
And did you see that detail about Visera?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I'll bring it up here, and then we can talk about a discussion that Lord Manderly's explains that Jaehaerys, the old king, had promised to right a wrong that had been done to his family in terms of, like, land being taken. And Jaehaerys, in pledge of that, this is page 416, he spoke of the wrong that had been done to us and promised to make redress. In pledge of that, his grace offered the hand of his daughter, Princess Visera, to my great-grandsire. Their two houses might be made as one, but the girl died and the promise was forgotten. We did not know that before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it says she was...
So that's new.
Like, she was betrothed to Theomore Manderly.
No, we knew that she had been betrothed, and then she died. She was the one that died in the...
Oh,
the
yeah, but not that it's about, accident. Like, a making up for the
not
fact
that... Not that Jaehaerys was involved. Mm-hmm. We didn't know that Jaehaerys was involved in it at all.
Right.
We had theorized that it had been because Alicent, Good Queen Alicent, had a good relationship with the Manderlys.
Right. Right, and that it was about, like... the wrong that had been done to the Manderlys, that they had, you know, been forced out. Like, basically, they had been usurped as well.
Right.
Their position had been despoiled of the birthright. So, yeah, and then he makes it to Winterfell, and he's, like, besties with Kriegan Stark.
Yeah!
And there's a lot of wild theories.
I have so many theories. We could talk about analysis. There's things... I wish the show had done. I wish the show had spent, like, more than 35 seconds in the North.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the story of Sarah Snow. So the story, as presented in the books, that Sarah Snow is the bastard sister of Kraegen Stark?
Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk about it in analysis. I have it down there.
Yeah. Okay.
There's several theories that come out of this, like, period of, like, Jace is hanging out in the North and what.
Yeah, and I love all of them. So...
It ends with, this section ends with Jace agreeing to the Pact of Ice and Fire.
Love that.
His future daughter married to Cregan's heir. And there's some symbolism that we will get to about this Pact of Ice and Fire and what it means.
Mm. Oh, yeah, because that would be a Targaryen marrying a Stark.
Specifically a Targaryen daughter going north and marrying a son of the North.
Interesting. Okay. Anyway. All right. We'll come back to it.
Yeah, we will. So, what's the Maester thinking?
In this section, the Maesters is primarily thinking that this war is happening and it's inevitable and it cannot be stopped.
Yep.
Even though, like, this first five or so pages, or six or so pages that we're reading, it's just people flying around talking to each other.
Yeah, like, so, just as we saw in the last episode when, like, the Maester says, what happens next is war! And, like, there is no war. Like, he starts, as you pointed out, like, he starts this section saying, like, the Dance of the Dragons had begun in earnest, and it's literally just, like, mostly diplomacy. Like, pretty much all diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, bloodless surrender.
The plan of it is to be diplomacy. Like, the plan is that she sent out these envoys to do diplomacy, not to go do any kind of, like, fighting.
Right. Yes. That she's, like, calling her bannermen and seeing who is going to be loyal. Not necessarily with the plan to fight. Like, we're still in the phase where, like, both sides are like, maybe if I have an overwhelming majority, the other side will concede. And we don't have to fight about it. I can just prove that, like, well, most of the people like me best, so you should step down.
Exactly.
So, like, yeah.
But war is inevitable, Gretchen, and it's gonna happen, and there's nothing you can do to stop it.
I also really enjoy, this is just a running thing that I enjoy, when, like, Gildane is, like, a super big hypocrite about Mushroom. Like, it's always very funny to me.
Yes.
That, like, when he says, well, you can't rely on Mushroom. Because, like, on 417, so he's talking about the North. And this is in response to, like, he's about Sarah Snow. And he says, this makes for a charming story, to be sure, but as with many of Mushroom's fables, it seems to partake more of a fool's fevered imaginings than of historical truth. Which is it, Gildane? Which the fuck is it? Is Mushroom just making shit up? Or is he someone that you can rely upon to tell you what really happened? Like, make up your goddamn mind.
When it's convenient for the Maester, Mushroom is true. When it doesn't matter, or is inconvenient, Mushroom... When it doesn't matter, Mushroom is maybe true, maybe not. When it's inconvenient for the Maester, Mushroom's wrong. He's wrong. He's not trustworthy.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And it's just one of those, like, whenever he does that, I'm always like, there is no way anyone... It's just, like, one of those where I'm just like, we should never take what Mushroom says at face value. Because if that, like, because it's so clear that the Maester is only using Mushroom in a way that, like, fits his bias.
Yeah.
With what he wants to believe to be true.
We shouldn't take Maester Gildane at face value. Right. That's, like, that's the whole point, is that, like, none of it's reliable.
Right, right. But when I hear, like, arguments in the fandom or things when people are like, well, but Mushroom said, I'm like, nope, sorry.
Nope. We're not sure Mushroom's even real.
Yeah.
In fact, we're pretty sure Mushroom's not real.
Uh-huh.
So...
yeah, but yes, it's come to the point that when I hear Mushroom, I hear the sexy rumors going around the Seven Kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, like, that is the role that this is just, like, oral history that he's decided needs to be, like, an actual text in order for him to cite it or not cite it as he wants. But it can't just be, like, this is just a bunch of rumors. That, like, were never compiled into a single resource.
Yeah, no, he couldn't put it in. But he has Mushroom's book.
Yeah, the only one.
You can't see it, but he has it.
Is the testimony of Mushroom in the room with us?
it's in the back room with the dragon babies. So you can't go there, but it's definitely there 100%.
Definitely there. Also, he really doesn't like the North, and he also really hates bastards. He's, like, super gross.
Regular Maester Gildane kind of shit.
Yeah, because, like, part of the reason he says that, like, Jace could never have had a relationship with Sarah Snow is that, like, he calls her half-wild, unwashed, northern bastard, and I'm just like, fuck
Jesus.
Off. Fuck off.
Dude. Winterfell has hot springs running through its walls. Like, they have baths.
They're probably cleaner than a bunch of other people who live in, like, the courts of King's Landing. Like, don't even. Yeah, because they've got hot springs. Also, it's colder up there. Like, if you don't take a bath when it's colder, you're probably not as gross as when you live in King's Landing and it's summertime and you're fucking sweltering and sweating all over the goddamn place.
Oh, gross.
Anyway.
Gross.
Anyway, yeah, just like a lot of people who are from King's Landing, they don't like the North, and they definitely do not like Bastards.
Yeah.
Bastards are the worst in Westeros.
In this chapter, he wrote the classics. Well, I love a good classic, anti-bastard bias.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's talk about what really happened. Daemon went to Harrenhal, and,
it's a lot earlier in the source material than it is in the show. That, like, the show delayed sending him to Harrenhal, I believe, until after Blood and Cheese.
Yes. Because
it was in response to Rhaenyra calls him out because of his involvement, and then he fucks off. But in the source material, Daemon is at Harrenhal long before Blood and Cheese happens. Like, it's similar to how the show put him in a position where he could be involved in Rhea's death. When in the source material, he's definitely, like, nowhere near the Vale, and there's no way anyone would have noticed that he would leave. Right. Like, they rearranged the movement of him going to Harrenhal. Because, like, in the show, in the source material, when Blood and Cheese happens, like, he's in Harrenhal hanging out, talking to the River Lords.
Yeah, so we can talk quite a lot about this, because there's quite a lot in the TV show now with Daemon and Harrenhal, because we had him there for, like, 1,000 episodes in season 2. I struggle with the amount. I mentioned this in our last episode. I struggle with the amount of time they kept him there. I think it was just too long. But they also had him do magic stuff, which is at least not spoken about in this text. But then again, how would Maester Gildane ever know?
Right.
If magic shit happened to Daemon Targaryen.
He talks about how people think Alys Rivers is a witch, but then
so we talk about Alys Rivers. Yeah.
And he says, like, whatever power she had, Daemon must have been immune to them. And again, you're like, how would you know? How would you know what happened? You weren't there. He doesn't have. It strikes me that part of the reason why this section is like what Daemon did at Harrenhal is so brief here is probably because he doesn't have any resources. Like, he doesn't have any sources for what happened. He's just like, yeah, he went there. Simon Strong surrendered, and then there's this other lady who lives there, but, like, he doesn't know anything about how they interacted, what would have happened, like. And I think it is also because Alys Rivers will become important. That, like, part of what is happening here is that, like, Alys Rivers will become more important in the story later on. Mm-hmm. And she is there. She was at Harrenhal while Daemon was there, so he kind of has to mention her. Because she will be important later on at a point that we will not spoil, that the show has not even gotten to. Like, she is going to become important.
And I wonder if... So my question was going to be, what do we think really happened at Harrenhal? I wonder if we need the rest of that story for what happens with her later, with the other character.
Right.
That we're being very vague about.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
To read into what might have happened here.
Right. Yeah.
Possibly. Mm-hmm. It's also possible that there were no interaction. That he went... He raised the host... And that was it. You know, it could have been that simple.
Right, but the show makes something of their interactions because of what we talked about last episode, which is that it's telling a story about Daemon's journey to understanding what the patriarchy has turned him into. And to, like, tell that story, they involved Alys Rivers.
Right.
As a part of...
Which is fine.
Yeah.
I must say, I was much more interested in her in the television show than I ever was in the book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. But she is a spooky, scary lady, which we haven't seen one of those for a while. We haven't had a spooky, scary lady.
I know. She's scary because she might be 40 years old.
She might be 40 and maybe sexy at the same time, and that's real scary.
Whoa, hold on. You cannot be 40 and sexy at the same time. That you can't do that.
Also, she's a wet nurse. And that's, like, I don't like the way he talks about her being a wet nurse, the way he's like, all of her children were stillborn. Is that because she sacrificed to demons? But she still has milk to produce to feed other kids. Is that spooky, scary? No, it's not. It's not.
Because it's spooky, scary.
It's not spooky, scary to be a wet nurse. It's not. But,
I don't know. Maester Gildane makes it sound pretty spooky scary.
Was she a witch who lay with demons bringing forth dead children in payment for the knowledge they gave her? No.
This is like Monty Python. She's a witch. Why do you think she looks like a witch?
She looks like one. Is she a simple-minded slattern? Probably not.
Wow.
She's a wet nurse.
Yeah.
She's literally just like a wet nurse who lives there. But maybe she's a wanton who used her poisons and potions to bind men to her body and soul. And I think, again, part of this has to be because of where she goes in her story, which we will get to later on.
Yeah.
But he has to be like, how could this, like, 40-year-old wet nurse play the role that she eventually plays in the story? She's got to be spooky, scary, simple.
Yeah. Man, I hate when I use potions and magic to bind men to me, body, and soul. It's the worst when that happens by accident and you stumble into that.
I know, right? Damn. I mean, I'd rather bind women to me, body, and soul anyway. Actually, I'd rather not do that either.
Yeah, so we take a firm stance against binding people to you, body, and or soul.
Yeah, but there's this whole weird thing about, like, is she 40 or older? Like, Mushroom wants to say that she's older. But, like, the whole point about debating how old she is about misogyny. It's like, is she an old lady that people think is sexy? Ew, how gross. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's worse if she's older.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, of course, only young women can be sexually attractive to any man of any age. As far as what we're given in the text right now, we will not go into what laters. As far as we know, she's just like a middle-aged wet nurse who happened to live there and might have been a bastard child because her last name is Rivers.
Yep. Could have been. I have a question. In the television show in Harrenhal, they show Harrenhal with a godswood with a weirwood tree.
Mm-hmm.
Did Harrenhal have a weirwood tree?
Yes.
Does it? Because it was built by Harren the Black shortly before Aegon invaded.
That says the godswood of Harrenhal consists of 20 acres of forest. I am looking.
20. Oh my god, that's a huge godswood.
Uh huh.
I mean, I guess Harrenhal is large, but still, that's massive.
Yep, there is a weirwood tree. So the godswood has a heart tree. Weirwood, it says, has an angry face carved on it, and it retains 13 slash. Yeah, 13 slash. Well, I mean, we'll get to there. There are 13 slashes.
We'll get there.
But yeah,
oh, that's right. Okay.
There is a heart tree.
Cool. I guess they built the castle around the godswood. I mean, 20 acre godswood's massive, so.
Yep. Yes. So yeah, who knows why Harren the Black decided to have a godswood? I imagine that it is probably because that was the local religious practice. And
yeah,
he might not have wanted to piss everybody off by not including it. Or just like, you know, whatever. Yeah, I think even technically, like, I know that King's Landing has a godswood, but it doesn't have a weirwood.
That's why I was wondering, because the show in the past has added weirwoods where they don't exist, so I was meant to check on that to see if that was accurate.
Yes, there is a weirwood at Harrenhal.
Okay. Good to know.
Yep. I think that Arya plays in it? I can't remember. I know that while she's at Harrenhal, she's, like, in the trees, like, slashing at the trees, but I can't remember if she ever specifically, like, plays in the weirwood.
I don't think
I know
she
prays to it. Like, she goes to the weirwood and, like, recites her list of names, I think. But I can't remember if, like, she is in the weirwood when she's, like, practicing with her fake needle, with, like, her with her broomstick.
Her tree branch.
Yeah, with her tree branch, yeah. But yeah, there is. The show was not wrong by putting a weirwood there. There is a weirwood there.
Good. All right, so then the small folks and the River Lords, and then there's like a bunch of details about how they support Rhaenyra.
But Gildane, last section you said that the small folk only used to like her when she was sexy. And here they are. Like.
But they also like her if she's Viserys' little girl. They have to defend Viserys' little girl. Did that make your blood boil too?
It did. Make me upset.
Yeah.
But, like, I just, like, before we get to that, like, I wanted to say that when Prince Daemon sent forth his call to arms, They, meaning the small folk, rose up all along the rivers, knights and men-at-arms and humble peasants who yet remembered the realm's delight. So beloved her father. Like, they were literally waiting. The small folk in the Riverlands are just like, Daemon's just like, hey, yeah, Rhaenyra. And they're like, I'm ready. I'm here.
Yep.
Here I am, fighting for my queen. Like, the small folk love her. No hesitation. There's no hesitation. Like, it's the lords in the Riverlands who are hesitating. Probably because they have more to lose. But the small folk are like, absolutely 100% Team Rhaenyra, just right off the bat. No question. But yeah, then it says, like, he has to, like, simultaneously sexualize and infantilize her. It's like, they remember, you know, the only reason they did this is they remember that she was the realm's delight, which is, like, they remember she's sexy, and or they want to fight for Viserys' little girl, which is deeply infantilizing.
Yes. Yes. They can't possibly fight for their, like, strong leader who is a woman.
Yeah. The, like, 30 or 40-something-year-old middle-aged woman who has kids. And is, like, the lawful heir. They must still be thinking
of her. And is, like, a dragon rider. And has dragon rider children. And has, right. like, all the things.
No, she's Viserys' little girl.
Why do you think that they chose to drag out the Riverlands plot for the show? Or maybe drag out might be the wrong word. I felt it was dragged out. But to make it more of a conflict that Daemon had to deal with. Was that just to keep him in Harrenhal longer? Question mark?
Yeah, I do think it's tied in with what they had to do with Daemon, because if they had sided immediately with Rhaenyra, Daemon wouldn't have had a reason to hang around as much. I think it would have been harder to justify Daemon hanging around if he weren't there, like, to try and convince the Riverlands to come to his side. I think I don't know if this is why, but I can see it fitting in with the fact that they trimmed down the number of available dragons to Rhaenyra on the show. That it is increasing the dramatic tension of how this civil war is going to go.
Like whether they'll actually get the, because the question becomes like, will they side with her? You know, and that's like one of the conflicts in the season.
Will Rhaenyra find support? I don't know how much emphasis I want to put too much on this, but I think it, again, this is a point where I could see someone making a case for the show and the book are doing two different things, that like the show is doing a thing of like the kinds of obstacles that women under patriarchy have to overcome in order to, you know, achieve their rights. And and the book is emphasizing that it wasn't really as much of a problem in Westeros as the Greens, that like, that in Westeros, it seems to me that like patriarchy was often localized within the Lord's paramount, within the elite, that like commitment to patriarchal structures is a mentality of the elite in the books. Like it's
We do see that for sure, like among the small folk versus the wildlings, and like, you know, the fact that it, and even just the fact that like in the north, for example, there seems to be more equality, because like when you need everybody to be working together to live, this like patriarchy crap kind of goes out the window,
right? And when you're a peasant, when you're a small folk, you can't really have the same level of patriarchy brain, because at the end of the day, like, someone's got to work in the fields. And if all you have are daughters, like, your daughters are working in the field. Like, you cannot be like, well, like, women are soft and they have to knit things. It's like, well, you got, like, crops to harvest. And if you've only got girls, then your girls are out there harvesting crops. That, like, in the source material, there seems to be, like, a sense that, like, that patriarchy is a mentality of like the upper classes, that is like, and they assume that the way they view the world is the way everyone views the world, and so they cannot imagine that the peasant, that like the small folk would side with Rhaenyra, when the reality is like the small folk are too like perfectly happy with Rhaenyra.
They're like, yes, that's the one the king chose, and we follow what the king says,
right?
And now we'll follow what the queen says. Absolutely.
And I think that So Martin is doing a thing about that, about like localizing patriarchal structures as kind of like a top-down thing that like is imposed upon society from like the powerful rulers who want to consolidate power amongst themselves and is therefore then imposed upon the entire society. And the show is not doing that same thing.
Correct.
And
it's just doing something different. Yes. It's not anything bad. It's just doing something different.
Yeah, they're emphasizing how deeply entrenched the patriarchal worldview is everywhere. And I don't think either one of them is right or wrong in a way that I think both of them are right. That, like, in their own way, that, like, there are, just looking at our society, for example, that, like, there are a lot of deeply patriarchal blue-collar and poor people who still do believe that, like, I would never vote for Hillary. I would never vote for Kamala Harris because they're, you know, I would never vote for a woman because they're, precisely because they're a woman. That, like, we can still find that mentality. It is not so clearly delineated as it is in Martin's, you know, at least here for Martin, that, like, we in our society, like, there still are quite a lot of people who are of, like, middle or lower classes who still buy into patriarchy in a deep way that is not just, like, imposed on them from above. But in a medieval environment, like, I think Martin is more accurately representing what would have been true in a an actual medieval society. And the show is more accurately representing what patriarchy looks like now in our society.
Oh, I like that. Yes, I agree. Yes, I agree with that. Because, yes. And, I mean, that makes sense because the showrunners are adapting something to screen for the modern audience. And right. That is something that is more... you know, resonates with a modern audience more and has more meaning to a modern audience. It's like, okay, if you're going to make commentary about, you know, medieval feudalism, that's great. I am never going to live in medieval feudalism. So I agree with you that it was bad. You know, I don't know what else to tell you. But yeah, I think you're right that it's sort of... And I wonder to what extent that's conscious or that's a byproduct of the fact that the writers are...
Right.
Modern writers living in, you know, modern society, and that is the way we interact with it.
Right, and, like, I can perfectly well see that, like, there are people of blue-collar and poverty classes who are as deeply patriarchal as the people who are in, like, the upper classes and, like, in the political establishment. Like, I can look at my world around me and see that this attitude is more than just like a top-down imposed worldview from the elites, that like there are a lot of people in my same or lower classes who are also deeply committed to patriarchal values.
And I think a lot of that has to do also with religion in the United States, at least with like Christianity, like teaching that patriarchy. We don't know how much the faith of the seven, like, how deep into that patriarchy the faith of the seven is. Like, we know there's the father and the mother, but, like, of the seven gods, three of them are women.
Right.
Three aspects of the god, rather, are women. You know, so it's not... I would bet that I would... Like, if I was interpreting the faith of the seven, I would imagine it still has patriarchy in it because it's, you know, part of a patriarchal society, but I don't think it would be as intensely patriarchal as... some forms of Christianity.
Right. Yep.
That, you know, that are like, obey your husband. You know, like, we don't have... Do we have any examples in the text of, like, obey?
Yeah,
We have some, like... We have some, like, you know, you are my king, my lord husband. Like, the fact that there is a lord and a lady, but there is a lord and a lady. Uh-huh. The lady also has a status.
Right. Right. Yeah, I don't know that we have any, like, passages explicitly from the seven-pointed star that point to that. And it's also hard to tell, like, how much of the embodiment of the faith of the seven is conformed to feudalism. Like, if the faith of the seven existed in a non-feudal society, would it look different than here? Like it's... That's because we don't know what it looks like outside of it. They're intertwined in a way that makes it hard to say how much of this is because the religion that they believe in imposes these values, and how much of it is that the religion has conformed to society's values.
Right. It's certainly a combination of both.
Yeah.
It's certainly a combination of both.
The one other thing that I will point out when we're talking about the differences here is that it is worth also pointing out that, like, Westeros also does not have seem to have the same deeply embedded white supremacy that we have in our society. And like in our society, patriarchy and white supremacy are like so intertwined that they are inextricable, which is a part of where I think to my mind a big part of why the patriarchal values are so deeply pervasive in our, more deeply pervasive in our society than we're seeing in Westeros, because in our society it is, patriarchy is so deeply intertwined with white supremacy and like a clearly established caste system that puts white men at the top, white women beneath them, and then people of color beneath all of those. But like, in order for that caste system to work, like you have whiteness involved, and within
need both patriarchy and white supremacy to create that particular paradigm. Absolutely.
Yeah, and there is Martin isn't really addressing racial dynamics explicitly as a systemic structure. He will address them individually, but not necessarily as a part of why it's not a part of the Westerosi cultural system the way that it is a part of ours. And I think that that is a big reason why it is more pervasive in our society, because even poor white people have bought into white supremacy. Many of them, not all of them, but like even the poorest white person believes themselves better than people of color. And part of that white supremacy is also a patriarchal structure where like white men are more, are superior to white women, and then people of color are below them. So like, yeah, there are differences, but yeah, and all of which is to say, like, Martin has some leeway in provided in depicting a Westeros that is less, where like the small folk can cheer for Rhaenyra because they are not as invested in patriarchal values.
Yes,
good for them.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, and I think that the difference between the book and the show on that point, that I really like that observation. That was really good. I hadn't thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is why I come to this podcast. Every time we record, I leave smarter than I was because you say smart things.
Well, thank you.
And I'm like, oh, look at that. I learned something today.
But that leads us actually really nicely into the way that Martin is depicting the blacks as like the side of the marginalized.
Mm-hmm. Which is, again, like, when people read this text, and I don't blame people if they get tricked on a first read because the book is trying to trick you.
Mm-hmm.
But come on, the blacks are getting together all the marginalized groups. Your women, your briefly we had gay people and then they all died. Your bastard children who were just pretending are not bastard children because who cares? Because bastards, like, it's this very like inclusive group.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're supposed to be the bad guys.
Right, right.
Like, come on.
Right, because literally in this section we see Lady Jane, who we love. We fucking love Lady Jane. She's great.
We do love Lady Jane.
She is a woman who has been defending her claim. She says for like that they, she, that people have tried to depose her 3 times. That like men have tried to take power away from her multiple times. Like, so she is another woman who is just defending her claim.
Yeah, I love that her uncle tried to take over because he thought that women were too soft to rule, so she put him in a spy cell, and he's still there.
Oh my god, I love that! Sir Arnold!
She's like, you can go ask him how soft I am in the spy cell.
No, oh, I love Lady Jane.
Love that.
Jane Eyre is great.
Love that. Fantastic.
I like to think she's gay. That she prefers the company of women. And not that she's just like a slut who fucks around a bunch of men. Look, she could be bisexual.
Yeah.
Like, the most important thing about Lady Jane is that she is explicitly not getting married. And that can mean a lot of things. I think that it most likely happens to mean that she is, like Queen Elizabeth I, is not getting married because she knows that getting married would mean losing her claim to her husband.
Yep. But also getting pregnant would.
Yes. Right.
Like, even if she wasn't married, if she got pregnant, it would be, like, a whole fucking thing.
Yeah.
Right? Like, she would, like, maybe even get deposed for that.
Right, you know? Yeah, because she would be so pregnant out of, without being married.
Yeah. So, I like to think she has a girlfriend or many girlfriends, a la Rhaenyra Targaryen.
Absolutely.
You know, her favorites.
Uh-huh. I agree.
Her very special friends.
Yep. And she has a great line. Do you want to read it? I have it in the notes.
Oh, yes. In this world for me,
of we men, women must sorry. Band together. In this world of men. Oh. I mistyped sorry. That.
Okay. In this world of men, we women must band together.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure you want to band together, Lady Jane.
Yeah, you want to band together with Rhaenyra.
Yeah. She's like, why doesn't Rhaenyra come visit for a while?
Yeah, I mean, my one, you know, I want dragons, but really, I would like a visit from the queen. It'd be great. Mm-hmm. But also, we learn in this section, you mentioned it earlier, that the Manderlys were victims of being usurped themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That, like... He says, mine own forebears were despoiled of their birthright when our enemies drove us into exile along these cold northern shores. So, like, this isn't yet another. Like, Rhaenyra is banding together a coalition of people who have been oppressed by right, society.
Exactly. And trying to give them protection and give them strength and, you know, defend them from usurpation.
Right. These are all like
or
go ahead.
Or to make right if they've been usurped, because if Manderlys that happened in their history.
Right. But this is like so it is like really difficult for me to understand the people who are like, well, the Greens are right. And I'm like, Martin is being really mm-hmm. clear about like the Blacks are the side of people who are under threat of having their either have had their rights taken away or are under threat of having their rights taken away in under patriarchal feudalism. And they are mm-hmm. banding together to like work together to say like, we deserve to have our rights defended. We mm-hmm. deserve to not be disempowered just because we're
sound
women.
Like villains. Sound like villains to me. Sound like that is a coalition of spooky, scary ladies.
You know, they might as well be Nazis like Danny.
Oh my god, they're Nazis. Why didn't I see the parallels?
Sorry. Makes me very upset. Season 8 of The Bad Show makes me really upset. Yes. Because again, this is what Daenerys also represents. Daenerys represents the side of the of groups of people who have been dispossessed. Mm-hmm. Or like disempowered or disenfranchised in some way. She literally has an army of former slaves. People who were literally enslaved.
With a little dash of white savior, though. A
little bit, yeah.
Her story has, like, a slightly different hue because of that bit. But, right. but that's still the idea, right? Like, she's trying to build strength mm-hmm. through giving aid.
Yes.
As opposed to building strength through threat of violence.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's what Rhaenyra is trying to do. Rhaenyra is trying to say, like, hey... First of all, you fucking pinky swore that you'd be for me. So,
awesome.
The fuck about that? Like, yeah. like we don't go back on pinky swears here in Westeros. And also, like, what's up? Like, what do you need to, like, be cool about this?
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, Jane Arryn's like, I need a dragon. Like, all right, that's totally, you know, totally fair. Like, we'll send a dragon to hang out with you. So, you're cool. Manderlys, what do you need? Like, you know, we were supposed to... Like, my grandsire was supposed to be married into your fucking family. Can we? And they're like, oh, yeah, sure, we got fucking tons of Targaryens. We'll get you one. We'll have one. Sign the contract. We'll make one happen. It'll be great. And then going to the north as well
mm-hmm.
and figuring out, you know, how to make common cause in the north. But, yeah, they're how do people think that she's the villain? I don't know.
Right, and we're going to meet more characters as the story goes on who fit the same paradigm of, like, especially women attempting to defend their authority. That, like, they yeah. should have the right to have power under the system. And, mm-hmm. like, without exception, all of the women that Martin names that side with anyone are women who side with Rhaenyra.
Yes.
Surprise, surprise.
Oh, gosh.
But yeah, do you want to talk about the North?
Yes, I'm very excited about the North. I love the North. I am massively disappointed that the television show did not actually give us time in the North. The fact that the season was only 8 episodes is unfortunate, because if it had been 10, I think we could have had Jason in the North for an episode. Just an episode. Mm-hmm. Just one. Just to give me a little more snow than we got. But there's so many things. There's so many. I don't even know where to start in terms of theories. Okay, let's talk about if they were boyfriends first, because that's my favorite one.
I love it. I love the idea that they were boyfriends.
On the television show, you cannot change my fucking mind that the actor who plays Chase and the actor that plays Cregan Stark did not have sexual tension. They absolutely had sexual tension.
Oh my god.
Oh my god. They were fucking each other with their eyes.
Yes.
And I loved it, and I wanted it to happen. And I don't know, maybe if the show gets even more fan servicey, they'll give it to me at some point.
Mm-hmm.
In the text, their age difference, I think, kind of shoots that in the foot. Because Jace is 14 and Cregan's 21.
Yeah, I don't really, yeah, mm-hmm.
That's like a college senior and a high school sophomore.
Uh-huh.
Junior at the best, but like more like sophomore.
Yep.
Which, like, I can see those two kind of people getting along, you know, like being friends. Like, that's like, if you're in college and you go to like your friend's house and he's got like a younger brother who like also wants to play video games with you. And is, like, a cool kid,
uh-huh.
and you all play Rock Bands together, you know, like, you're bros in that sense, right? Like, you bond over playing Rock Band. Here, they're bonding over, like, war or whatever.
Yeah, they hunt together, train together, and swore an oath of brotherhood sealed in blood.
Aw.
They're just good friends. Just good friends.
In the text, because of the age difference, I think they are just good friends. I don't know. Maybe they have some, like, homoerotic stuff in their feelings, but they haven't acted on it.
Uh-huh.
I don't think within the text that they've acted on anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I
definitely don't think he spent his time trying to convert Cregan Stark to the faith of the Seven, which Septon Eustace says is what Jace was doing. I was like, Cerys Velaryon fucking cares about the faith of the Seven. Excuse me.
Not at all. Not even a little bit.
No.
My primary piece of evidence for the fact that I think that they just broed out. Is that they named this pact the Pact of Ice and Fire. Now, that's, like, really cool, and it has, like, a lot of meaning, and we'll talk about that thematically, whatever. But, like, think about them coming up with the name for this contract. So, first of all, they come up with the contract. They're like, okay, we're going to do this marriage thing. Like, that'll be nice. That makes sense. Like, that'll be cool, bro. Then we'll be related, bro. Yeah, bro, that's great. They're like, what do we call it? And I'm sure they threw out, like, a lot of dumb names at each other. Like the North and South Pact, the Winterfell Dragonstone Compendium, you know, like all kinds of crazy shit.
The Dragon Wolf and Pact.
The Dragon Wolf Pact, yeah. Oh, but dragons don't go in packs, only wolves. Okay, well, can't do that one. And then one of them was like, oh my god, I got it. The Pact of Ice and Fire. And the other one was like, dude. And they were so excited about coming up with that. And I could just see them being so bros about it and being so excited about their little contract and giving it a really cool name.
Uh-huh.
For something that I'm pretty sure never comes up again in the text.
Nope.
Yeah. But, like, they gave it a really cool name, though. That's what matters.
Uh-huh.
And you know they wrote that shit over the top of the contract in, like,
yes.
big letters.
Yeah.
Definitely did.
Pact of Ice and Fire.
Ice and Fire. Big letters. Yeah. So anyway, that's what I think. I think that they were very good bros.
Mm-hmm.
Genuinely. What do you think? You think they fucked?
I lean towards the idea that there was some kind of romance, at the very least, some kind of romantic attachment there. Mm-hmm. Because I think Sarah Snow is fake.
No, you can't think Sarah Snow. I love Sarah Snow.
It's a mushroom story, though. Listen, I knew that we were going to differ on this, and you know what? It's fine. But, like,
no.
I have another reason. Like, we can talk about, like, the second reason, which I think is related to the Pact of Ice and Fire, as to why I think even if she doesn't exist, they did not get married and they did not have sex.
I don't think that part happened. No.
But I feel like there's some kind of romantic attachment there, because I feel like Mushroom made up Sarah Snow to, or like that the rumor of Sarah Snow is to undercut the possibility that there was something queer happening between
I could definitely see that happening.
They're like if Jace fucked anybody, it was definitely a girl, and she was his bastard sister,
and he definitely married her before he fucked her, because he's honorable,
right?
So honor,
yeah, honor,
much honor. He
married the bastard sister, and then he fucked her, and everything's fine, and there was nothing gay, like, no homoeroticism, no, you know, they really were just good friends.
Yep. No, I could see that too. I thought about that as well. In terms of Sarah Snow, I just like romance.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
I like a romance. I don't believe if she did exist, like if you were to adapt it where she existed, I don't believe it would have been like that they got married, but I believe they like would have fucking fooled around or fucked or something like that. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, it's his first trip alone without mom. He goes north. He meets a pretty girl. Mm-hmm. You know, they make out at a party. He goes home. You know, that kind of thing. Nothing wild. Nothing like totally crazy. I mean, he's also 14, mm-hmm. which is like, you can have sex at that age. It's still kind of young.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Maybe he was sexually frustrated because he couldn't have sex with Craig and Stark, and so then he had sex with Sarah Snow instead.
Okay, I do kind of like, this is just my brain seeing here a connection then between Robert Baratheon and Ned Stark, where like, mm-hmm. Ned definitely had a thing for Bobby B. Mm-hmm. 100%. You cannot convince me otherwise.
I mean, he had that fucking big black beard and the muscles, man, and the hammer.
Right, come on. And the way that Ned like thinks about Robert Baratheon being muscled like a maiden's fantasy, I'm like, or muscled like a Neddard Stark's fantasy? Is that what you're talking about? But anyway, you cannot convince me that like Ned did not have some feelings for Robert Baratheon. Mm-hmm. You could pry that from my cold dead hands. I'm 100% convinced mm-hmm. of that. And I think that I like to think, there's a part of me that likes to think, tinfoil hat, I'm putting on tinfoil hat, that, like, part of why Ned was totally fine engaging his child, like, to Robert's child was because of this, like, unfulfilled romantic desire of, like, look, aww. If I can't have Robert, then at least my child, you know, then, like, at least we can marry our kids together. And, like, there's you could see a little bit of that happening here of, like, look, we can't be together, but, like, maybe someday my kid and your kid can get married. And that will be the same, right? That'll be close enough. Like, we can't do it, but, like, maybe our kids can get married.
Mm-hmm. I could definitely see that.
But that is because I like angst. I like my romance with a touch of angst. So I'm sitting here going, but the unfulfilled desire, and it's displaced under their children, and oh, it's painful and good.
But you could do the same thing if you did an adaptation. You could have Jason Cragen, like, you know, making eyes at each other the whole time. Uh-huh. And then have it so, like Jace goes back to his room and, like, encounters Sarah Snow.
Yeah.
Either earlier or later on the way back or whatever, and then, like, fucks her, like...
I can't have Cregan, but maybe I can have totally.
You could do both. It'd be great.
Yeah, you can do all.
Wait, but my problem is we needed it on this television show that's allegedly an adaptation of this book, and instead, we got like 35 seconds of it, and then Cregan said, "I will definitely be there in season 3," and why?
See you later.
I could have cut 2 to 3 scenes of Matt Smith being in Luigi's mansion for 2 to 3 scenes of Jace in Winterfell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're... Or, like, I could have cut... Every scene of Rhaenyra reading a scroll at her desk could have been cut by 15 seconds, and we could have had enough time for Jace in the North. Like, there's just things that I was like, why am I watching this, and I'm not watching Jace making out with Cricket Stark?
Mm-hmm.
Give me what I really want. Show the people what they want. Come on.
I do agree with you that, like, I'm glad they at least nodded to the fact that the North matters and that they're reminding us that, like, there is a bigger threat involved, you know? Mm-hmm. But I do also agree that, like, I wanted more time in the North. Like, I wanted... I feel like you could even argue that they don't necessarily even need to cut anything from the other storylines. You just let Jace stay there longer, because like once Jace comes back, he's just kind of, I will be, no offense to the actor's doing a great job, but like Jace isn't really doing a whole lot this season, which is like not a complaint. He's the heir apparent, and like his biggest, the emphasis on Jace this season is the, like, the frustration of not being able to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And like, do we really need, like, 8 scenes of Jace being like, Mom, let me do something, and her being like, no, you're the heir, you gotta stay, you gotta, like, I'm trying to protect you, and him being like, meh.
And that would be even more impactful if he had been north and actually done something.
Mm-hmm. Right.
like, if he'd been in the north and, like, I don't know, he's hunting with Kragan and they get set upon by wildlings or some sort, and he gets to actually fight and,
right,
you know.
I also think, yeah, and I also think it could have, you could have still done the same thing, and it might have been even more effective if he had been in the north, like, doing shit, accomplishing things, like, you know, going hunting, fighting, maybe have, like, you could create a scene where, like, there's, like, a wildling attack and he helps save Kragan Stark and there's tension.
And then
they kiss, for example, where he's, like, doing and, like, being active and doing things and then comes home and is told to, like, sit around and do nothing. Like, I think that would have emphasized even more strongly Jace's frustration this season of, like, why can't I do something? Is if you showed him getting an opportunity to, like, let out that impulse and then to come home and be stuck doing nothing.
And to be good at leading, like, to show him, like, learning in the north, like, leading, you know, leading a little army, doing, you know, doing diplomacy, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But alas.
Right.
Instead, he stood around and just had the sharpest jawline on set.
Just Timmy Chalamet.
Timothy Chalamet around.
Yep. with his luscious brown waves and sharply chiseled face.
He's on, like, TikTok, I think, that kid, and he's, like, so sweet.
He seems like a great person at IRL. Yeah. He's great.
Yeah.
He seems sweet. I agree with you. I think that's one of, now that I've seen most of the season, I feel like Jace was not given enough. And I would have liked to see more of him. I think that if you did have a character, another thing, that if you did have a Sarah Snow in the North, regardless of what kind of interactions they have, like, Jace being able to specifically interact with another bastard.
Ooh, that's a good point.
Would have been really interesting. And I think would have, again, highlighted what we see in episode 7 when he, like, goes to his mom and is basically like, the only thing that makes me special is that I get to ride a dragon and other people don't. If you're allowing all of these bastard Targaryens to ride dragons, why, like, you know, where he's, like, basically saying, like, he only feels like he has power as a bastard because he can ride a dragon, and if other bastards can ride dragon, he perceives them as threats to his own authority, which, that's a scene that I kind of wish Rhaenyra had responded differently. Like, I kind of wish that she had been like, well, but you're my heir, and I will name you my heir, and the whole point is we're fighting, this conflict is about, the throne should go to the person that the previous ruler says. You know, that, like, my dad says I should be queen, so I should be queen. And if I say that you are my heir, then, like, you are my heir, and it doesn't matter who else can ride a dragon, and it doesn't matter what their parentage is. Like, you will be the king because I say so, because you are my child, and I will name you king. Like, I wish that she had said that, because that's the whole point. But, like, I think that if Jace had been able to interact with another bastard on screen and see the way that that bastard was treated by society intimately and up close, it would have, like, again, emphasized the angst that he feels by the end of the season of, like, if all of these other Targaryen bastards can claim dragons, why does that make me, like, am I special at all?
And it could have even gone a step further, because it could have had that problem introduced but also had it resolved within the season if he met Sarah Snow as a bastard. But, like, say she was, like, a cool girl, like a Black Alley type. Like, she was, like, of the North, and so she, like, fought and could do a bow and, you know, do all, like, whatever.
Right.
And if she kind of taught him, like, you know, yes, like, yeah, I'm a bastard, but that's not what defines me.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, he could still see people treating her differently.
Right.
And he could still see that she didn't, like, you know, live in the castle at Winterfell and things like that. She was, that society was trying to keep her down, but she could kind of be, like, you know, I won't let... Like, I'm not letting society keep me down, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then for him to go back, be confronted with these other bastards who are a threat to him, but then realizing that lesson, that it's not, like, your parentage is not what matters.
Mm-hmm.
What matters is that you're, like, you're the heir and you're chosen, and you know, don't judge people for being a bastard.
Right.
Like that could have been really great. HBO, sweetie, can we get an adaptation of the source material, please?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one instance where I feel like they missed an opportunity to, like, really highlight character work for, like, a secondary character. That they could have done more. Like, I'm not saying that what they did was bad. I just think it could have been a lot better. They could have done more with Jace. Even to emphasize the things that they are emphasizing with Jace. Like, they clearly want to make a big part of his character this season be about his frustrations of not being able to do anything. And then, ultimately, like, how he feels about being a bastard. And, like, they could have, like, emphasized that even more if they had paid attention to what was happening in the North. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I agree. Speaking of what's happening in the North, did the dragon lay eggs there?
I don't know.
Probably not.
Probably not, but not for the reason that Gildane gives.
Yeah, but the dragon is male, Gretchen. The concept that they can change their sex is just so silly. Nobody can do that.
Yeah. For those who don't know, you know, where he says, Sept and Barth okay, so he says, whilst it is true that determining the sex of a living dragon is a nigh on impossible task. So he's admitting, you can't actually do this thing. But he says, no other source mentions Vermax producing so much as a single egg. So it must be assumed that he was male. But you can't determine a dragon's sex. Do we know that all female dragons have eggs? Or even if dragons are binary, which we will talk about, but even if they were, do we know that all female dragons lay eggs? Also, it says we don't have a source that says that Vermax laid eggs. That doesn't mean that Vermax didn't lay eggs. It just means we don't have a source that says so. Mm-hmm. Vermax also doesn't live very long. Spoiler alert!
Spoilers!
Vermax doesn't live like 500 years.
I must say I am glad to know that it's hard. It's like impossible to sex a dragon because that means there's no like giant dragon dicks all over the fucking place. Yes. Which is comforting.
Yeah, I like that.
Because that would be very bad.
Yeah, because then Sept and Barth says, Sept and Barth's speculation that the dragons change sex at need, being, quote, mutable as flame, unquote, is too ludicrous to consider. Fuck off.
Fuck off. Sept and Barth knows way more than you, bro.
Right, also too ludicrous to consider. Why? You literally just said it is impossible to sex a dragon. And then are like, well, it's impossible to sex them, but, like, one thing we definitely know is that they don't change sex. Like, You literally cannot know that. You literally cannot. You have just admitted that you cannot ever know if they change sex because you can't actually sex them at all.
I'm surprised they haven't, like, done a dragon autopsy. Like, because they wouldn't have had, what was the one that died in Dorne? They wouldn't have Meraxes. Meraxes? What was
that one saying? Meraxes.
They wouldn't have had access to that dragon's corpse, so they would have had Balerion's. And he died relatively recently. I'm surprised no one was like, sweet, a dead dragon. Let's finally open it up and see what the fuck is going on. You know?
Yeah. I wonder if someone at some point did, and that's the kind of stuff that ends up in the, like, now missing Sept and Barth's of dragons, worms, and wyverns. Like, if that's the kind of thing that, like,
yeah, maybe
is in there, but it's, like, forbidden knowledge. Like, I do think that if someone was like, hey, I want to cut open this dead dragon, that, like, a lot of the society would be like, no?
Well, they have to do something with the corpse because, like, we have the dragon skulls. Balerion's skull is in King's Landing.
Do we know what they do with dead dragons?
No, we don't. There's no, like, dragon graveyard or anything.
It would not surprise me if they burned them the way that they do the Targaryens. If they had, like, another dragon burn its corpse. It would not surprise me.
Yeah, that would make sense. It probably would preserve the bones. Like, you probably could burn off the flesh and get the bones. But, like, I don't know. If you can't tell what sex it is, just wait for one to die and take a look. You know?
Yeah. But all that would really tell you is what sex it was at death. It wouldn't tell you whether or not it changes sex.
Yeah, but maybe when you get closer, you'll get a better look into, like, oh, this one has, like, I don't know, some kind of genitalia on the outside that we didn't notice before, because before it was giant and breathing fire at us. You know, like, it could just be that no one's gotten close enough.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think that Martin doesn't do that, because I do think that he... like, that it's important that we can't pin it down.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's got thematic significance, mm-hmm. which we'll talk about. You know who should have written a book on all this shit? The Dragon Tamers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if that knowledge is lost in Valyria somewhere. Mm-hmm.
By the way, this is like an aside. We talked about this last episode a little bit, also, because of the episode 7 that you watched. The whole concept of, like, only Targaryens can ride dragons and only Targaryens can control dragons, whatever. All of the Dragon Keepers, all of them, are non-Targaryen.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They control the dragons just fine.
Yep. But they're, like, a special religious order.
Oh, so the dragons are, like, only Targaryens and also these people that are dressed like airbenders. Got it. Done.
Well, would the Dragon Keepers be able to ride them?
I don't know, but they command them. Mm-hmm. They use their sticks and poke them in certain directions, and they call them up from the pit.
I also
they say Vermisor, come here, you know.
And, yeah, I also don't think that any of them would attempt to ride a dragon, because
right. The
pervasive belief is that only Targaryens can ride them.
Right.
But you are correct that like some of what undercuts that idea is that there is a whole order of people whose job it is to like interact with these dragons in a way that, like,
the dragons move the dragons around, mm-hmm. if the dragon is injured and needs help, if the dragon needs a little bath,
right,
you know, and clean up after the dragon. I mean, these are people, regular people, that are regularly around these dragons,
right. A groom in a stable could ride one of those horses, mm-hmm. because they have a relationship with them,
right,
and the horse trusts them, so, like, yeah,
right.
They may never do it because of the, like, pervasive belief that only Targs can ride dragons, because the Targs have successfully...
And the threat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the threat of, like, if you ride it, like, the king's gonna kill you, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, you're stealing from the crown.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I believe that they could. But back to the idea of Vermax laying eggs. Like, I know that, like, this is really... There is a popular... There are a lot of people in the fandom, from my interactions with the fandom, who like the idea that Vermax laid a clutch of eggs on Dragonstone.
But for what purpose?
Up in Winterfell. There is symbolism in A Song of Ice and Fire that there is a dragon at Winterfell who will hatch. But mm-hmm. the dragon is not literal. The dragon is Jon.
It's Jon, yeah.
Like, it doesn't, you don't, like... This is how symbolism works, people. I'm so sorry. But, like, symbolism is metaphor. Like, you don't have to have a literal dragon. Like, if you have symbolism that points to a dragon at Winterfell, you don't have to have a literal dragon, because you have a metaphorical one. You have a symbolic one. Like, that's how symbolism functions. But, like, I do think that, like, a lot of the desire to think that maybe Vermax laid a clutch of eggs there is because of this symbolism that we see in A Song of Ice and Fire, that, like, there's a dragon and the dragon will wake, and, like, so there must be dragon eggs there, and where would the dragon eggs come from? Well, Vermax was there, and, like, mm-hmm. and, like, of course Martin put this in as, like, a tease, mm-hmm. but, like, the dragon is Jon. Like, the dragon that is going to wake in Winterfell is Jon Snow, and I happen to not believe that there will also be a literal dragon. Some people do think that there may be a literal dragon as well, but, like, the actual dragon that Martin cares about that is going to wake at Winterfell is Jon Snow.
Yes. I think, yeah, I agree. That was the thing about the clutch of eggs. I'm like, okay, he lays a clutch of eggs, and then what? Nobody at Winterfell notices for 150 years there's a clutch of dragon eggs?
Or, like, tries to find them? You're telling Nothing. Me that, like, if this rumor was going around, people were not trying to find them? Like, not even just the Starks, but, like, literally anybody who heard this rumor would not mm-hmm. be, like, going to find the dragon eggs?
You know what? Here. This is what I'll give you. If you were going to go, like, so fan fiction in this adaptation, just, like, tinfoil hat off the cliff, okay? Jace goes to Winterfell. He and Craig and Stark fall in love. They make a pact that they're going to marry their kids. He leaves dragon eggs there so that the children of them will have dragon eggs.
Okay.
dragon, and they're like, oh, we could totally hatch them here because
the hot springs.
Winterfell's walls, hot springs, boom. Just like, it's like the ice version of lava. It's the hot springs.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, see, because it's hot water instead of very hot fire.
I think that if someone wanted to say that there were eggs there, it would be because of the Pact of Ice and Fire.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
But only if Jason, Craig, and Stark make out. I only accept it if they make out before.
That is the predecessor. If you want to have eggs at Winterfell, you gotta have
the price for eggs at Winterfell. His boys kissing.
Yes. Agreed. I'm into that.
In the gentle snowfall in front of the heart tree. Yeah. That's all I want. Right.
I could get behind that. I agree with you. That is literally the only.
I'm shocked you would agree with that.
The only circumstance that I will allow that Vermax laid a clutch of eggs is if Kreek and Stark and Jace Velaryon fell in love. Then I will accept that Vermax laid a clutch of eggs at Winterfell.
Can I please get a fan art or something like DeviantArt to like animate that and draw that out as a comic strip for me? Oh, I would be so grateful.
Oh, it would be good. I'd be into that. But yeah, otherwise, okay. and even then, like, it just, yeah, like, Vermax did not lay eggs there. It's just...
Oh, God. Okay, so that's the analysis of what happened. So who gets shafted? Alice Rivers, for sure. And her ability to produce milk.
Yep. That sexy lady has got to be doing spooky, scary shit in order for her to be sexy if she's old. It's got to be a witch.
And the small folk, why would you say the small folk would get shafted here during the Dance of Dragons? That's so weird.
I am thinking specifically of the way that Gilding talks about them.
Oh, yeah, that would be, that on top of all the death that's going to happen, is going to definitely be a way that it gets shafted.
Yeah, the way that he's just like, ah, those peasants, they only like queens if they're hot, or children. They cannot have thinking brains.
Oh my god, when you say it like that. Oh, that's pretty funny. Oh man. Okay, I was promised themes from the Pack of Ice and Fire, so please, because I read that when I was reading the section, and I was like, oh my god, I know Gretchen's going to tell me some great shit.
Yeah.
So hit me with the great shit with the Pack of Ice and Fire.
There is, so this connects to the prince that was promised, in fact, that, like, there are some, like, I have seen people make the connection between the Pact of Ice and Fire, this, like, promised wedding. We also see it with the Manderlys. And that, like, the prince that was promised, that the promise is actually a wedding promise.
Oh. Okay.
That, like, the promised me, that, like, the specific content of, like, the prince that were princess, because Maester Aemon will say, like, princess that was promised, is about a wedding pact that has never been fulfilled. That there's this, like, that Martin plants these, like, unfulfilled wedding pacts between the North and South that we never see fulfilled. But there's this, like Manderly says, like, Jaehaerys promised Viserys to my grandfather, and it never happened. It's your job to make it right. And then Jace makes another promise to marry his youngest brother to Manderly's daughter, who then doesn't, and that marriage doesn't happen. This Pact of Ice and Fire doesn't happen, is never fulfilled. That there, like, that there is this, like, and there are other ones that I can't remember, but there's this, like, thread of, like, these, like, unfulfilled wedding promises, that there is, like, a marriage pact that is promised between the North and South, and it never gets fulfilled, and that part of the, like, prince that was promised prophecy, that, like, part of the promise is that, like, there should have been a wedding that, like, consolidated and unified the North and South that, like, never happened and is, like, open.
Is it specifically the Targaryens and the North?
Yes.
Okay, because there must have been Southern houses that yes, married. I mean, right. We have Catelyn Tully, right. You know.
But it is specifically about ice and fire. Of
ice
like,
and fire, right.
You know, that you can see it show up in, like, Manderlys and Targaryens. But, like, it's the essentially it is between the Targaryen house and a Northern house, most often the Starks. But you can see it, like, symbolically represented with the Manderlys or something, you know. Or even... no, I'm thinking of something else. But anyway, like, there is this, like, promised wedding that should have unified these two factions that is, like, always about to happen and is unfulfilled.
That's interesting. Like, the promise is, like, the prince or princess's promise is that the prince or princess is promised in marriage.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Not promised, like, by prophecy.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, or, like, to be born by prophecy. Interesting.
But promised
oh, I
in
like
marriage.
That.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh. Right. So then when Rhaegar and Lyanna finally...
Right. Rhaegar believes himself to be the prince that was promised. And what does he do? He goes north and marries a northern woman. Mm-hmm. But it is because he believes that he is the prince that was promised that he goes north and marries Lyanna.
Uh-huh.
But is he the prince that was promised? We don't know. But, like, it is because he believes himself to be that he takes a northern bride. That, like, he, like, one of the theories around what that means is that he believes that, like, in order to fulfill that promise, he must marry someone from the north. That, like, he's fulfilling the promise by marrying someone from the north because ultimately the promise is a wedding pact. That there should be a marriage that happens. So he has to take a northern bride. But if Dany is the princess that was promised, it is ultimately then about her and Jon. And whether or not there is something that happens between her and Jon.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the, like, part of this theory is that, like, perhaps one of the things that got wrong, that went wrong with, like, the Children of the Forest and the White Walkers and, like, the kind of ancient fight between, like, ice and fire is that at some point historically maybe there were warring houses that should have resolved their conflict through a marriage. And that marriage pact was never fulfilled, or it was broken in some way, or it was, like, maybe it was fulfilled but then damaged. Like that, but that, like, ultimately the conflict should be resolved, like, peacefully through a marriage pact. That, like, that is the way that you resolve conflict is, like, is the war of words. It's diplomacy. It's marriages. It's, like, by unifying people into common cause.
Well, I think that, well, I was about to say about the unifying aspect, because I do think one of the major themes for Martin is that, what I call disempowerment of women disempowers us all, or you could just expand that to disempowerment of any group disempowers us all. Like, as soon as you begin to create division and treat people badly because of that division, we all suffer. The counter to that is that for all of us to succeed, we need to be united. And one major way to unify people is through the tradition of marriage.
Right.
And of saying, you are now legally bound to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular world, that unifying, like, marriage leads to, like, the creation of children, which is, like, genetically unifying the families, you know? In a very permanent, lasting kind of way, right? Because you're creating all new people.
Right.
That are a combination, I guess, maybe the best way to put it, of of both sides.
Right.
That's really interesting. Oh, I like that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it's something that I think is really interesting. Like, I really like the idea behind it that, like, ultimately Martin sees conflict resolution in terms of creating unity rather than, like, martial prowess, you beat the other person on the battlefield. That, like, we will see it even... We're seeing it at the beginning of the Dance with Dragons with Rhaenyra and Daemon being like, how about we let's try and talk things out? What you were saying earlier, like, what does another person need to feel safe so that they can, like, side with me? And a lot of that involves marriage. That they're like, let's, you know... Loyalty, like, the assumption being loyalties cannot be divided if we are a part of the same house. If we are part of the same family, essentially,
right,
then we are unifying our loyalties to each other. It is a way of building loyalty, combining loyalties by creating a new family.
Right, and building protection, building strength, mm-hmm. things like that.
And we will Absolutely. And we will see it later on at the end of the dance. But like, mm-hmm. that, I mean, this is something that we've seen with a lot of the female characters, right? Like Rhaenys understands mm-hmm. that like the way that you build peaceful coalitions is you marry people. Alice Anne mm-hmm. understood the way that you build peaceful coalitions is you marry the kids to each other.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what the dance means to that theme though about the family being unified when the dance is a civil war within one family. Mm-hmm. You know?
Right.
And like if there's a point, I don't know if they're related or if that's just commentary on the fact that like the Targaryens had gotten to, you know, they got to the height of their power and then they fell kind of thing, which is a different theme that Martin likes. Because you would think that the bigger the Targaryen family is, the stronger it is. But maybe that goes to what you've talked about with the patriarchy, that
right.
the patriarchy destroys everything and the Targaryens being a microcosm of that.
Right, because...
Yeah.
Like, ironically, and I think that Martin is aware of this, like, marriage is, like, can be a tool to build coalition, but, like, we see that within the Targaryen family, marriage is also a means of usurpation, right?
Right.
That, like, especially the usurpation of women, that, like, how do you disempower a Targaryen princess? You marry her to a Targaryen man.
Right.
Because he's the only thing that would have more power than her. Like... Mm-hmm. Rhaena can't be her own power. Like, Maegor has to marry her and basically, like, attempt to sublimate her power into his own. Right. And that, like, marriage can serve both functions. Like, ideally, in an idea, I think that my sense is that Martin views marriage as kind of like a neutral thing. That, like, mm-hmm. In a structure that is disempowering, marriage is a tool of disempowerment. Especially mm-hmm. for women. In under patriarchy, yes. marriage is a tool of disempowerment. Mm-hmm. But not under patriarchy, like, marriage could be this like tool of equality and this tool of unifying. And I think that he can mm-hmm. see both of those things. That, like, marriage, I also think, stands for connections more broadly, that like it isn't just mm-hmm. about like only marriage serves this function, but like marriage is a specific example of like how you create community and connection between human beings.
Yes
that like he's mm-hmm. using it symbolically that way, and when it serves that function, it is representing like a tool of coalition and equality and like bonding together. But under patriarchy, marriage is also primarily functionally a tool of oppression for women and a way to like steal their power from them.
Right, exactly. Hmm.
That like and within the Dance of the Dragons, like we see various situations in which marriage can function as coalition building. Like Rhaenyra and Daemon is a really good example of that. If we take the more neutral view of Daemon, that like Daemon was not like this power hungry asshole who was attempting to like usurp Rhaenyra's power, but like that is a kind of like, we are both powerful dragon riders, and if we work together,
then we'll be even more powerful together. Yeah.
But like the attempt to marry Aegon to Rhaenyra would have been a tool of usurpation, would have been the Hightowers attempting to usurp Rhaenyra's power by putting Aegon right. in charge. And ultimately, mm-hmm. the Greens can only understand Daemon as doing that same thing. That, like, if we put Rhaenyra on the throne...
If we put Rhaenyra on the throne,
we're mm-hmm. accepting Daemon's rule. Because they can only imagine right. marriage as a tool of sublimating female power.
Right, exactly. Huh. What do you think about the fact that it's called the Pact of Ice and Fire? I mean, I like my headcanon that they came up with that name and they thought it was neat, but... Right.
I think that is the best Watsonian explanation for what happened. Yeah. Is that these are just a couple of like teenage and or young adult boys who just thought it sounded cool.
It sounded really neat. But if you include the Targaryen magical prophecy, mm-hmm. and if you have Jace know about that before he goes north, which he does not in the show, mm-hmm. But not before he goes north, then
Could it be that after falling in love with Craigan Stark and everything, he tells Craigan about the prophecy? And that they, like, name it the pact after the name of the prophecy.
Yeah, that, like, part of what they're doing by creating the Pact of Ice and Fire is attempting to fulfill the prophecy of the Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah.
That is why they call it Of Ice and Fire. I really like that. I don't know that we can, like, definitively pin that to the text, but I really like that idea that, like...
Yeah, I don't think we can definitively pin that to the text, but I'm also very much going to just embrace that the two of them were in love and that we can't definitively pin that to the text either.
Right. I do...
Because they didn't call it the Fire and Ice Pact.
Nope.
Right, and they didn't call it the Ice and Fire Pact. They call it the Pact of Ice and Fire, which is
what
remarkably like the Song of Ice and Fire.
One word away from the Song of Ice and Fire.
Right. It's remarkably close.
Uh-huh. Right.
So.
Right. And I do think that that on the Doyleist level, that is a signal from Martin that we are meant to associate what is happening between these two with the Song of Ice and Fire, with like what the Song of Ice and Fire means is like, if you're calling something, if you're a writer and you have a thing called the Song of Ice and Fire and you're dropping hints that it's about like this conflict between, you know, the magical powers of ice and of fire as embodied in the Northern House, the Starks, and then the you know, the House of the Targaryens, which are fire. If you're doing that, and then you have another book in this universe, and you have two characters call a thing the Pact of Ice and Fire, and it's a marriage pact.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to think of these things as related. Because you're like, it's just, to me, you're trying to get people to think of these as being related to each other.
It also potentially has a relation to the pact.
Yeah, long ago. Yes.
Because it's not called the Agreement of Ice and Fire or the Contract of Ice and Fire or the really cool thing we wrote down of Ice and Fire, right? You know, it's like the pact is also a word that calls back to an ancient agreement, you know, that has a sort of ancient magical root to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't know. I think it'd be kind of cool.
Yeah, I've seen people talk about that, like, you're right. I'm pretty sure that connection has been explicitly made, that part of the pact with the children was also meant to be a marriage pact, that like humans and, you know, the Andals and the children, that the part of this pact was they were meant to intermarry and be united with each other. And instead, the Andals start burning all the godswoods. You know, that like it is a pact gone wrong, that like what should have been two peoples unifying and like working together and living in community, and you know, like it went wrong because one of them decided to conquer the other. Like one of them chose violence rather than working in community. But yeah, there are some people who have argued that like the pact was actually like a marriage pact.
I think I have read that before, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would make sense in this universe for all these kind of pacts and promises to be these very practical, like, marriage things. Like, that would track for this universe.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. It is one of, in a feudal society, it is one of the ways that you build coalition, is to marry people together. And we do things differently now. We can do more than just marriage, but, like, it fits within the world that Martin is playing in, that, like...
Mm-hmm.
Coalition building is fundamental, like it often boils down to marriage between two people, and
well, especially in feudalism, in a medieval feudalism. I mean, that kind of is the only way in medieval feudalism. So, oh, I love that. Okay, all right.
Mm-hmm.
So that was themes.
Yeah,
I love that.
That was themes.
Oh, I love that. I was going to spend the rest of the day thinking about Craigan Stark and Jacerys Velaryon, but whatever. Okay. Next time, we're reading more sections.
Mm-hmm.
We're reading from where we ended on page 418.
Sorry, before we move on, I just have to, I looked up the pact, and I just have to, as a correction, please don't at us. The pact ended the war. It was not before the war. between the first men and the children. The pact was like they had been fighting, and then they made a pact to end the war. And I still, like, it doesn't change the content that, like, I'm pretty sure this was a marriage pact. Like, it would make sense for this to be a marriage pact, because a lot of how you end conflict is to marry, like, at least in Martin's world, in the world that he's depicting, one of the primary ways that you end conflict is marriage. You marry your kids together. Under that thesis of, well, we can't fight each other if we're family. I mean, we all know that you can fight each other if you're family.
Yes.
But the assumption being, like,
I've seen it in this yearbook,
You end the conflict through marriage. So, like, the pact was about the children of the Force and the first men who had been at war, and it ends with the pact. And I still think that it was very likely a marriage pact.
Yes, don't flood our inboxes.
Yes. And then they're friendly for a while, and then the Andals come in. And the Andals come later, and then they fuck everything up, so...
Yes, as Andals are wont to do. So we're reading from 418 through... Ooh, there's a pretty picture in here.
The end of the chapter.
Is it the full end of the chapter?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah. So there's a... This is definitely... The next episode is going to be a big old trigger warning.
Yep.
If you've watched the show, it's blood and cheese. So you know what that means. If you don't know what that means... It is going to be a trigger warning for child death, pretty explicitly on page.
Yep.
So, just so you, there's going to be two child deaths in the next episode. So, just, you know, if that's not your thing, totally understand. Fair enough. I personally, I actually haven't reread Blood and Cheese for a very long time. It was usually when I read it, I skip this that section. It's been a while since I read it.
I think it's been a while since I've read it in full. When I watched season two, I went back to check a couple of things, but I did not reread the whole thing. But I just, like, looked up, like, oh, wait, yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah, that same.
I have not reread it entirely, so.
All right. Well, we will for next time. Yay!
Yay!
Yay! All right. Our email address, if you want to email us, is houseoffireandbloodpodcast@gmail.com. Our Instagram is houseoffireandbloodpodcast. You can contact us in those places. If you have any interest in coming onto the podcast, we always love guests. Or if you want to just tell us how we're doing, if we're doing good, if we're doing bad, if whatever, however you feel, you'd like, tell us. And if you say something nice, we'll read it on the podcast. There you go. Boom. Okay, until next time.
This podcast would like to issue a correction from the until next time of last episode. Last episode, I told you all to remember that the plebs only like women in power if they think they're fuckable. I would like to issue a correction and say that until next time, remember that the plebs will like a woman in power not just if she's fuckable, but also... if she can be infantilized as in need of protection. I just, you know, look, we accept our errors here. I misspoke. You know, plebs will like a woman that they can, you know, treat as a little girl and believe that they need to rise up and protect her. So,
yeah, you're absolutely correct. We are dedicated to accuracy on this podcast.
Yep.
So it's really, really important to correct that one. And until next time, remember... if you're trying to convince me personally of some crazy dragon shit, just know that I will always accept it if it is accompanied by two boys kissing in the snow. So, if you want to sell me a crazy dragon theory, that's fine. I just need to know that there are two boys kissing nearby. And then I'm there with you.
Is that true for dragon babies?
It might be true for dragons. I need a specific example.
Magor's kids were dragon babies because I can't think of any dude that he was close to.
Right? Oh. Damn.
Yeah, it doesn't work for that. Oops. Oh, well.
Yeah. So if anyone wants to come up with one and send it in, I'll let you know if I agree. Because at first, Dragon Eggs in the North, I was like, absolutely not. Totally made up. But I was like, but what if they were making out next to the Dragon Eggs? And then I said, you know what? Plausible.
Yeah, what if they were making out and then Vermax was like, I see where this is going. I should leave some dragon eggs for any future children that might come of this doomed romance.
Yeah. I think that's what that must be what happened, 100%. That's what... We don't even have to ask George. That's clearly what happened.
Right. Yeah. No, this is just text at this point.
Yeah, that's basically what it says.
Anyway, bye, everybody.
Anyway, thanks for listening to us, guys. We'll talk to you next time. Bye. Going?
Yes.
Okay, we are.
I also don't know if I have any Easter egg shit.
You should have been recording when we were talking about French fries.
Shit. Now no one will ever know our opinions on French fries.
Though actually the place I mean the place around me that has the best French fries is I don't always like to buy there because like it's their burgers are expensive. Mm-hmm. It's like a fancy burger place. But mm-hmm. Their French fries come with a bunch of different seasoning options. Like, you can get, like, Cajun seasoning or ranch or garlic. There's Old Bay. My favorite is truffle. I love their truffle fries.
Oh, you like truffle fries. Would they put on their cheese?
No, it's, like, truffle salt.
Oh, okay. So we have a place near where I work. That we always go for drinks, and the drinks are great, but their food is trash. And everyone's like, "Oh, but I love their because they like specialize in hot dogs, and they're like, oh, I love like this hot dog and that hot dog. I'm like, their hot dogs are trash." And they're like, "Oh, well, you can get the truffle fries, but their version of truffle fries are like fries with like just everything on top of it. It's got like cheese and, but it's a bad conglomeration of things. It's like not good."
Right, no, like, if you're going to call them truffle fries, like, it's like truffle salt. Like, it's literally just, like, they add salt that has truffle flavor in it. Like, truffle, ground up truffles in it. And so
you has everything on it. They're like, truffle fries. I'm like, no, this is something. This is the homunculus that of fries that you tried to summon. You tried to resurrect truffle fries from the dead, and this is what you came up with. Like, I don't know what this is.
Do you know what a truffle is? People, do you know what a truffle is? This is not poutine. Yeah. Like, if you called it poutine,
it looks like poutine. That's actually kind of what it looks like. But it's not good like poutine. I've had poutine.
Right. Yeah, I've had some very good poutine. I've lived in Wisconsin. I live reasonably close enough to Canada that there are some good poutine options. But I feel like I would want to be like, are you confusing poutine with truffle? But even if you are, this is still a bad version of that. But, like, this is definitely not truffle.
The next time we go, I will. Someone inevitably orders it because everyone else is like, these are great. And I'm like, your taste buds are shit. I don't know what's going on.
Maybe they're...
I'll take a picture and I'll send it to you.
Yeah, take a picture and send it to me because I will see it and judge it. The place that I like to go, the Bad Apple, they also have curry fries, which, like, depending on who makes them, can either be really disappointing because they don't put enough curry seasoning on, or they can be, like, the best fucking French fries you've ever had. Because, like, I just love curry seasoning on things. In things, I love curry. But, like, curry fries, they're so good. I do really love French fries when they're really well done.
Yeah. For our listeners, before we started recording, what is now apparently our Easter egg, we're talking about French fries, and we did agree that Burger King has a better burger but worse French fries, and McDonald's has better French fries but a worse burger. Mm-hmm. And we were hypothesizing that maybe the corporations made a deal to specialize so that we keep going back to both places.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, because I think that, like, your Whopper is, like, better than just, like, a burger.
Whopper Junior meal, that's what I get. Love that. Mm-hmm. But I'll get the onion rings because the fries are always disappoint.
Yeah, and even their onion rings are, like, they're fine. They're better than French fries.
They're okay. They're sometimes a little soggy, which is disappointing.
Yeah.
You know? Like they don't have that like oomph that they need, but
They don't have the crispy, the right level of crispiness. I like my French fries with the skin on. I know this is probably a controversial opinion in some places in the world, but I like the skin on my French fries.
You mean like the whole potato?
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Yeah, like that's actually slightly healthier.
to the extent that French fries can be healthy. That's slightly healthier for you because it has the skin.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which is how I feel about my mashed potatoes. Like, mm-hmm. I prefer my mashed potatoes kind of chunky, but like a little bit on the chunky side. Not like just chunks of potatoes, like a little bit, because I like the skin on in my mashed potatoes.
I like all forms of mashed potatoes.
Right. Have you ever had Irish Colcannon? It's my favorite thing. Oh my gosh.
Oh, what is that?
Oh my gosh. So
what's it called? Irish what?
Colcannon. Colcannon. Colcannon.
Colcannon, okay.
It is mashed potatoes made with like cabbage in it.
Oh, interesting.
It's really good.
I actually might have had that because in Poland they add cabbage to everything. Uh-huh. So there's a chance I've had that before.
They probably call it something different there, but I grew up eating it because my we would celebrate St. Patrick's Day with like an actual like Irish meal. Mm-hmm. We would have like my mom would make corned beef and we would have like roasted vegetables, and my mom would make Irish soda bread, and she would make Colcannon, which was always my favorite thing. And my mom knew to make like an extra large batch of Colcannon because I would just eat it for like the next couple of weeks afterwards. I would just be like, I would like to just make a bowl of Colcannon, put some butter on it, maybe some cheese, maybe some like sharp cheddar cheese, and I would just eat Colcannon. There was something about having the cabbage in it that like, because you boil it first, and like if you boil it in like broth, like it's still kind of crunchy, but like it has like a little bit of like saltiness. It's just like it's texture heavy.
It absorbs the flavor,
It's really, really good. I cannot find any place around me that makes it, so I know if I wanted Colcannon, I would have to make it myself.
Oh, that's actually good though. Oh, I love mashed potatoes. I haven't had mashed potatoes in forever. Maybe I'll get, maybe I'll do something crazy tonight and go get like Boston Market. Get some fucking chicken and mashed potatoes.
Yeah, there's a Popeyes
living on the edge.
There's a Popeyes around the corner from where I live, and that was another one of those things that I could eat when I was recovering from my hysterectomy, was like mashed potatoes.
Aww.
So my girlfriend would occasionally, like, she would go out and she would get me just a container of mashed potatoes from the Popeyes around the corner.
Aww. You know who has a really good mashed potatoes? Also Kentucky Fried Chicken.
They do.
I fucks with those mashed potatoes. Ugh, they're good.
I know they're just good. Ate lunch, but now I really want potatoes of some kind, mashed potatoes.
I'm wondering if I can convince Frank to get a Kentucky Fried Chicken for dinner. He loves Kentucky Fried Chicken, but it like fucks up his stomach every time.
Oh no.
But, you know, you have to sacrifice.
Some things are worth it, okay? Sometimes you have to sacrifice your stomach to appease your mouth.
Exactly. I think there's 100% support that.